The Guardian.
24 hours a day, 365 days a year, MI5's English language analysts listen to lawfully intercepted conversations, picking out essential information that will help us counter terrorism across the UK. They're the kind of people who don't miss a thing, who can listen for hours on end without losing concentration, who can pick out the important information and stay calm under pressure. They work well on their own, and even better when they're briefing the team on what they've discovered. If this sounds like you, visit the MI5 website to find out more and apply.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. The economy's stuck, the Tories are split on Europe, and the West has waged war in the Middle East. Have we gone through the noughties and bobbed up somewhere back in the early 1990s? There's even rumours of a new tour by the Stone Roses. Later on, we'll hear from the former Labour MP Chris Mullen, who chronicled that decade in real time. But first, joining me in the studio, we have The Guardian columnist Seamus Milne and The Observer's Nick Cohen. Welcome to you both. Well, with characteristic taste today, the Sun screams, "That was for Lockerbie," above the bloodied head of Colonel Gaddafi. The slightly more subtle line from David Cameron outside Number 10 yesterday was that it was not just the West, but also the Libyan people who had finally got their man. Now, Seamus, you're a serial intervention sceptic, but when you saw those cheering crowds in Tripoli last night, did you wonder whether you'd called this one wrong?
Well, of course, you know, there is a large section of the Libyan population, maybe the majority, who wanted to see the overthrow of the regime. And so that was true at the beginning. It's no surprise that people are delighted when a regime that they've hated over a long period falls. I think the problem with the intervention is that it's taken the leadership of what's called the Arab Spring out of the hands of the Arabs. It's put the West and Western powers once again in the heart of a regime change in an Arab and Muslim country. And what's actually been left in Libya after perhaps more than 10,000 people have been killed, when there was the chance of negotiation and ceasefire, which was repeatedly vetoed by the NATO powers, is an extremely unstable situation where there's a leadership which is backed by the West, mostly Islamist fighters on the ground who don't recognise that leadership. And I don't think we've heard the end of this story at all.
Nick, what do you think?
Well, obviously we haven't heard the end of it. The word that sort of jarred with me in what Seamus said was unstable. There is a belief common across left and right in Britain that somehow dictatorships are stable. They're not. I mean, dictatorships are sitting on pressure cookers. And the idea that you could negotiate with Gaddafi or that, you know, things could just be left the way they were when there was a possible massacre in Benghazi strikes me as just completely false.
You know, you don't think there could have been a ceasefire?
It didn't happen, did it? You're talking about... It's something... I find this morning's newspapers profoundly distasteful. Mm. There are endless opinion pieces by rich white men who've never known suffering, who've never known tyranny, all, you know, desperate to say, this is awful. Comfortable people in the West have no idea what it's like to live under a tyranny for 43 years, to have its propaganda.
Even if that's true, you wouldn't say most newspapers this morning are saying...
In the comment sections, across the board, from the Mail to the Guardian and back again. And obviously, it's going to be a very, very uncertain future. To give Gaddafi credit, at least he didn't die a coward. He didn't behave like a coward. He did fight to the end. It would have been far worse for any new administration in Libya if he had just popped across the border into Algeria or into one of the Central African states where he's pumped quite a large amount of money. The future would have been far more unstable because it would be a constant rallying point for opponents of any change. So, you know, there is some good news in all of it.
Do you think there's a problem for the regime with the fact he was seemingly shot in the back of an ambulance rather than being captured after being caught alive?
Maybe. But one other point, though. Seamus said this is West intervening. It is sort of, but this is what is interesting about what's happening in Libya is at least Libyans can say they made their own revolution. You know, there were apart from spotters... There weren't Western troops on the ground. They've done it themselves. That is quite important. There is all the difference in the world between being invaded, even if you support the outside invasion, by a foreign power, and of fighting yourself and making your own revolution, having your own revolutionary heroes, and having a new narrative for a society which, you know, for 43 years has just, you know, been force-fed absolutely insane ramblings of Gaddafi's Green Book, which, you know, if readers can find it, listeners can find it on the internet, they really ought to look at. And that has been the official ideology. So at least they're creating their own future.
There is, Seamus, isn't there, a bit of a distinction there between, you know, the sort of Iraq situation where there's lots of Western troops on the ground and the Libyan one where it's there's bombing, but there's still more of a sense that the...
Well, it's obviously a different model, but I think, in a way, it's much more similar to what happened in Afghanistan at the beginning of the intervention in 2001, where basically US and British special forces combined with a heavy bombing campaign tipped an existing civil war into the overthrow of the Taliban regime. And that didn't work out quite the way people are talking now about Libya. I mean, I don't agree with Nick that the Libyans have made this themselves, unfortunately. I think that's one of the great problems of what's taken place. We see symbolically yesterday, it was actually a French airstrike that attacked the Gaddafi convoy, which then allowed the Libyan fighters to capture him and kill him in cold blood. And really, that's symbolic of the whole intervention. You know, I think it's unarguable that the rebel forces would not have prevailed against the Gaddafi regime without NATO's air power and intervention, and including some special forces on the ground. So I think, in a way, that's my earlier point, that it's taken away the ownership of what's called the Arab Spring in Libya from Arabs. And that's a very dangerous and problematic thing in a region where Western intervention and support of tyranny has been at the heart of the problem over the last century.
OK, well, whatever goes on next on the ground in Libya, it could still drop off our front pages. And that will have a bearing on how it plays out for David Cameron, who is trying to look very statesmanlike yesterday after, you know, what might be seen as a clean intervention compared to
Blair,
what happened in Iraq. And Blair never got his Baghdad bounce. No. Do you think Cameron's getting it bounced?
I don't think politicians, either David Cameron in Britain or Sarkozy in France, I don't think they get much from this. I don't think politicians get much from foreign policy victories. They get a lot of trouble if foreign policy goes wrong, of course. You know, David Cameron just did the right thing, and his political opponents ought to admit that. You know, he and Sarkozy were confronted with, as we have seen, a rapacious army at the gates of Benghazi, and they intervened to stop it. I can't see any evidence. I don't know. I haven't seen any opinion polls since this war. I doubt if there have been any and how reliable they are. But the idea that there's going to be a great leap in conservative support because of this, I just find hard to say, partly because, you know, it's very, very boring coming on these programmes and saying the same thing week in, week out. The economy just dominates everything.
Seamus, do you dissent from that at all? Do you think it's...
No, I mean, obviously, the fact that no NATO troops were killed in this intervention and all the deaths have been among Libyans, and they're very, very large numbers. We don't yet know the numbers, but they're, you know, perhaps 10 times what there were at the point of intervention, means that obviously here, for people, unlike, say, Afghanistan, where British soldiers are being killed regularly and the war is extremely unpopular, it doesn't really register that heavily with people, except through TV reports like last night, which are very gung-ho for the intervention. But I think Nick's right that it'll just... unless there's a renewed civil war in Libya, which is obviously a possibility, that's going to drop off the agenda pretty quickly here.
So, as Nick says there, the economy is likely to be the bigger issue in Westminster in the coming months. And this week there's been a particular shock on the inflation front. According to the Bank of England, homegrown inflation is almost zero. And that'd be great, apart from the fact that there's so many other sources of imported inflation that the retail price index is creeping up at its fastest rate for over 20 years. Food prices up 6%. And if you're planning on switching on the heating this winter, it's almost a fifth more than it was this time last year. And all of this, of course, spells big trouble for the government. Larry Elliott is The Guardian's economics editor.
The inflation figures are bad news for the government's deficit reduction plan in two separate ways. The first is that state benefits, including pensions, are uprated according to the September Consumer Prices Index, and that's gone up to 5.2%. So the cost of state benefits next year in 2012 is going to be higher than the government thought. It's probably going to add about £2 billion to the budget deficit, all things being equal. The bigger way, I think, in which it's going to affect the government's deficit reduction programme is through its impact on growth. And what's really happening there is that prices are going up by in excess of 5% a year, but wages are going up by less than 2% a year. So there's a big gap opening up between what people are paying for their goods and what they're getting in their pay packet, which means that their real incomes are shrinking. They're getting less money in their pockets at the end of the week this year than they were last year. And that's putting a real dampener on the economy. It's stopping consumers from spending. And since spending is something like two-thirds of all national output, it's obviously leading to a much slower rate of growth. Slower rate of growth feeds through into the budget deficit by a smaller amount of tax take for the Treasury and a higher amount of unemployment, which leads to higher benefits. So you'll see that the deficit will be higher next year than the government's expecting because growth will be lower. And the reason growth is lower is because inflation is higher.
So bad news for the Treasury there. But the Bank of England believes that inflation has now peaked. The figure for this month could be a blip.
Well, it's not really a blip. I wouldn't really call it a blip because this blip has been going on for the best part of 2 years. And inflation has been below its 2% target since the start of 2010, and we're now nearly at the end of 2011. So it's a bit more than a blip. Where I do agree with the Bank of England is that I think inflation will come down next year. It will come down because some of the reasons it went up this year won't be repeated. So we're not going to see another increase in VAT. We probably won't see a similar increase in oil prices that we saw this year. And those things will drop out, and therefore inflation will come down because of that. And also, the fact is the economy is pretty much dead in the water. I mean, there's no demand in the economy, very little domestic inflationary pressure, and higher unemployment and weak growth will mean that inflation will come down because of that. So I think the bank's right. Inflation next year is going to come down pretty sharply. And that, in the end, although it will take some time, should be good for growth because people's real incomes will go further. People will find, perhaps at the end of 2012, early 2013, that their earnings are going up by more than inflation, and therefore they will have a bit more money in their pocket to spend. Trouble is, I think, that that takes time to feed through into people's consciousness. It's not going to be an instant thing. It's not going to be that people one day wake up and think, oh, all of a sudden I feel a lot better. It will seep through into their consciousness over a period of months. And I don't see that happening very quickly. I think the shock to their spending power and to their sort of confidence has been so great that it will take a long time to mend.
Nick, it's interesting, isn't it, that people have often said about recessions in the past, from the 1930s to the 1980s, that a government can get away with very high unemployment as long as that's affecting unemployed minority.
Yeah.
But it sounds from what Larry's saying there that really this big squeeze this time isn't just on a luckless minority, but on the majority who are in work as well.
Apart from the rich, yeah. What's interesting is that how un-Tory this government's economic policy is. There used to be quite a dividing line between left and right. The left thought the worst economic ill was mass unemployment. Therefore, it wanted low interest rates, weak pound, whatever. The right thought, no, it's high inflation. It hits our people, it hits savers, it hits people putting money aside and don't want to be a burden on the state. Good people, prudent people in their view. And actually, in one way, this government has adopted quite a left-wing policy in keeping interest rates very, very low, lowest they've been since William and Mary's day. And I'm just quite staggered about the lack of pressure on George Osborne and Mervyn King from, if you like, the Conservative side of the political argument, from Conservative MPs and Lib Dem MPs. There doesn't seem to be this attack on Osborne for saying, look, for goodness sake, reduce VAT. Or tell Mervyn King you cannot go on with interest rates this low, which you would expect from right-wing politicians, because it really is. It hits everyone. In particular, inflation hits the type of people who traditionally would vote Conservative or maybe Lib Dems. And as Larry was saying, the very poor and pensioners are at least not having real cuts, whereas people in work are. And I wonder how long the Conservative Party is going to put up with this. I mean, Larry keeps saying it's a blip and it's going to fall next year. This has been the longest blips ever. With due respect to Larry, economics pundits' forecasts on inflation have been consistently wrong. They've consistently underestimated it for 3 years.
But of course, the thing that normally pushes inflation into an upward spiral is wages itself. Wages go up and then prices go up and so on and so forth. But that's the bit, Seamus, that's not happening, isn't it?
Yeah, because demand is, you know, through the floor. There's a global crisis, and you know, there's people have no leverage in the labour market in such a situation. I mean, I do take issue with what Nick was saying, because I think it's actually a classic Tory economic policy. It's perfectly true that they're damaging the people who electorally they usually like to appeal to, savers and pensioners and so on. But the people who are not being damaged are the people that they most clearly and absolutely represent and traditionally represent, namely the bankers and the banks and the financial sector, which is, of course, doing very well out of this policy. And, of course, the Tory party is most of its funds come from the City of London, as The Guardian recently showed so graphically. So I don't think it's true that it's not a classic Tory policy or in any way a left-wing policy. I mean, people at the bottom end of the income distribution, although their benefits are being protected in this uprating, they're being cut in lots of other ways, and they're being hammered in lots of other ways. But I think also we are starting to see some political reaction about that. You know, you see it through the Daily Mail, through the Tory right, which is becoming fretful about a number of things. I mean, at the moment, it's projected on other issues mainly, but such as Europe. But I think, you know, you'll get more of that because there is an important part of the Tory party constituency that is being damaged.
I do think, though, Nick's onto something, isn't he, about this idea of people who put lots of money into a building society account, if interest they're getting none of, and then prices are going up at 5%.
Yeah, I just acknowledge that. Yeah.
So, I mean, it is a bit different. I suppose the Bank of England's independent, though, isn't it? And that's another difference.
Well, no, but I'm saying that traditionally the Tory party has been the party of the city. And that was true in the 1930s, 1920s and 1930s, very classically. And it's true now. And the people who are benefiting most from the management of this crisis are the banks and the richest, as Nick acknowledged. So I think that's the distinction I'm making. It's perfectly true that sort of, you know, middle-class people who the Tories have traditionally tried to appeal to electorally are being damaged. And the question is for the Tories politically is whether that can be overcome soon enough, as Larry was talking about, for them to be saved, their bacon to be saved in 3-4 years' time.
The banners outside St Paul's this week, where there are the anti-financial system, anti-capitalist demonstrations modelled on Occupy Wall Street, say we are the other 99%. And Nick, if you take both the idea of squeezed middle-class savers and squeezed median or typical wages, do you think that phrase has resonance now in a way it hasn't in the past?
There is some truth in it, yes. Lots of people have mocked or patronised these protests, and they are very vague. And there's an awful commitment phobia, which you see across a lot of politics at the moment, of wanting to protest but not saying what you're protesting for, not having demands which tie you down, because you have to make a commitment. And then once you make a commitment, other people can disagree with you or say, actually, I don't share that commitment. But there is a very strong feeling in Britain, and it is a vague feeling rather like these protests, that, hold on a second, British society seems to be, you go to school, you get your exams, you get a job, you work hard, you pay your taxes, and the government gives your taxes to bankers. That doesn't seem quite right or quite a very good way to run an economy or any kind of just society. And there is just this, the crash of 2008 is like 9/11 or the fall of the Berlin Wall. It is an event that changes a vast amount. And, you know, even Ed Miliband, you know, I appreciate, you know, he's often mocked and whatever, and is regardless no hope. He does seem to understand that in a way that I think a lot of people still don't. To have a society that's taught you run on free markets, you know, and you allow the richest people in the country, whatever they earn, that's not a problem. And then when they fail, they are bailed out with taxpayers' money. You get very, very strong left and right wing revulsion of that. From a right wing point of view, hold on a second, we were all meant to be against bailing out lame duck industries and giving people something for nothing. And all of a sudden, you know, you're bailing out these people who then don't change, who then accept no responsibility, carry on giving vast bonuses, sometimes directly with taxpayers' money or indirectly through the support the taxpayer is giving the banking system. And I think that will have profound consequences for British politics.
It's only a few hundred people at the moment in the City of London, isn't it, Seamus? But, I mean, are you encouraged to think that it's they really are speaking for a much wider constituency?
Well, clearly. And, I mean, you know, in America, where this has been going on for several weeks and has... I mean, it's also not a huge number of people in the Occupy Wall Street protests, although they spread all over the country to other cities. But it's won support from the most unlikely sources, like the New York Times, you know, mainstream commentators. President Obama has talked in a sympathetic way about the protests. And that's clearly because, you know, as reflected in public opinion polls in the US, it does, you know, there is a lot of sympathy to what they're saying for exactly the reasons that Nick is saying, which are reflected here as well. I mean, in all the economies which are most closely associated with Anglo-Saxon type economic model, that's where this phenomenon has grown deepest and fastest, of the, you know, runaway concentration of wealth at the top of society. I mean, that 99% slogan is very accurate if you look in terms of income distribution and wealth as it's developed in the last 25, 30 years. It's happened in a more extreme way in America, but it's happened in a pretty extreme way here as well, and under governments of both main parties. And so I think that's now come to a head. And what we were talking about a moment ago about the issue of the Tory party and its different constituencies, I think, you know, that this is reflected in that as well. Why is the Daily Mail so angry against bankers? Because a lot of its own readers and the people, the so-called middle England that it identifies with, which isn't actually middle, but it's the middle class people that they want to protect the interests of, are being hurt by these policies. They've been hurt by the crash, and they don't like the fact that people at the top end, you know, are ripping off the system and have runaway wealth, which is affecting them. So it's fracturing the Tory party's natural support base. And I think that's significant in the sort of strictly party political Westminster sense.
I think it, running into the autumn and strikes about pensions and so on, the interesting question will be, won't it, whether those will be seen as sectional, you know, public sector minority against majority private sector workforce, or whether instead... in the context of this, we are the other 99% stuff.
I think that's a crucial point. I mean, the attempt of the government, and they've been backed up by the media to the hilt in this, is to try and isolate public sector workers, give the impression that they're feather-bedded and gold-plated pensioned and so on. And so that when they take action, to try and isolate them from the rest of the population and regard them as a sort of privileged special interest group. And I think the from the point of view of the trade unions and people who want to see a change of economic policy and these issues which the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy the London Stock Exchange movements are focusing on, want to see, it needs to overcome that isolation. So anything which brings the interests of the wider private sector employed or unemployed population with the public sector is important. And I think these protests are focusing on that broader interest, which we've been discussing. And I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether that starts to feed in terms of public opinion.
And what do you think, Nick, just very briefly, do you think the mood is now right for the minority of public sector workers to resonate more broadly?
Well, I mean, I disagree with it. Well, we'll see. We'll find out. But the gist of what Shane's saying, I think it's going to be very, very hard to get support from working lower middle class people for, say, I don't know, teachers or university lecturers to keep their pensions. I mean, not that they shouldn't go on strike, they're perfectly entitled to fight for their terms and conditions, but I mean, that is not a cause you want to, you're going to get lost people rallying around. I mean, the trade union movement has sort of failed over the past 30 years. It has not broken out into the new working class, into the service industries, into shops, into call centres. It's become far more public sector, far more middle class. And so, you know, good luck to people fighting to defend their terms and conditions. I will be pleasantly surprised if there's a great upsurge of public support for them.
Well, as you both say, we'll know soon enough how the strikes play out. But in the meantime, there's another form of direct democracy that's generating a fair bit of interest. This new mechanism whereby people can give petitions and then politicians are obliged to debate things. And this coming week, all eyes are going to be on Europe, where at the behest of mostly, but not exclusively, people on the right, there's a push to have a debate in the House of Commons on whether there should be a referendum on Europe and whether Britain should get out entirely. Are we in a new age of democracy, do you think, Seamus, for this sort of thing?
Well, that would be definitely over-egging the pudding. I mean, it seems to me it's a positive thing, but it's a very, very small-scale phenomenon. It's barely even a sticking plaster. But, I mean, what's not to like that people have the chance to force a debate in Parliament from outside? I mean, you know, they're perfectly reasonable criticisms about it being manipulated by special interests and lobby groups. But, you know, if... I mean, it's good that Parliament is being forced to discuss the issue of the European Union and the rights of people to have a say in how it's run and Britain's relationship with it, when the political class for 30 or more years has tried might and main to stop that happening, and all sorts of decisions are taken, often which are very negative for people, not only in this country, but across Europe, which they have no democratic input to. I mean, people are well aware of the democratic deficit throughout Europe and the European institutions. And of course, that's true in Britain as well. There's a democratic deficit here. So things that bust open the system a little bit in terms of parliamentary debate has got to be welcome, but it's so small scale. And the reaction of the parties is shows that there's actually many more powerful forces which prevent what people want addressed in the country being addressed by the political class. But, you know, that said, it's obviously positive in a very small way.
You say it's a step forward, but Nick, don't you think people could end up even more frustrated? There's plainly not going to be a referendum of the type that hundreds of thousands of people have signed up for.
It is very important that politicians take on populist attitudes. Don't just say, oh no, we don't want this bothering Westminster. You know, there are millions and millions of people in this country who feel hugely frustrated about the EU, who feel, think they were conned into going there and now think all their reservations are being borne out by the collapse of the euro. David Cameron ought to have a debate with them. He ought to be able to explain, well, actually, no, this is why I think it's we shouldn't leave the EU. And you take it on. It's a great mistake to just push people's concerns on the EU or immigration or hanging, but pretend they aren't there. You have to go out and argue with them. And I think this is rather a good measure, unless it forces the House of Commons to debate things that perhaps wouldn't otherwise be debated.
Yeah, but debate, but not decide. I mean, isn't that the...
Well, you know, I mean, we're a parliamentary democracy. You know, it's it might leave people more frustrated. There's been too much the past 20 years of people... You hear people say, oh, we're not allowed to talk about this, or you're not meant to say this, or no one ever talks about this, that, and the other. It's normally rather hysterical and...
untrue.
And untrue. But, you know, it is good that... That Parliament is talking about, and the leaders of the country have to come out. I mean, it's quite clear Cameron doesn't want to talk about Europe at the moment. But the fact he's got to is rather a good thing for a Prime Minister,
okay.
I think.
OK, so you're supportive of that. And what about what it does to the state of the parties? Ed Miliband's having a bit of grief this morning with Labour people who are saying that they think that the people have been conned out of a referendum on Europe too many times. But, of course, principally, it is the Conservatives. With talk of a mass rebellion of up to 50 or 60 MPs on this referendum that Cameron doesn't want, Seamus.
Well, I think it's a real problem in politics that in Britain that this issue has been dominated by the right in politics. I mean, that's not true in other parts of Europe, for example, in France. And I think it's important that left and progressive voices make their own case about European institutions and the European Union order and the euro, which, of course, you know, progressive people were making before the euro was set up. And,
I mean,
and we've been vindicated.
The argument against the euro is a rather left-wing one. I mean, you know, the best arguments against it are really rather left-wing. It's been more the centre. What happened with Europe is it's sort of nice people had to, along with a lot of kind of attitudes, had to support a central bank without a central government or any means of resolving tensions within its currency area. I don't know how on earth that happened. You need a sort of, I was going to say a social historian, more a psychological historian, to explain that. There are plenty of people on the Labour side who have as much doubt about...
And still are.
And it was Gordon Brown, in perhaps the best decision he made, that didn't take Britain into the euro.
But do you think that there is a danger, just because there's so much baggage for the Conservatives, of looking like little Englanders and flag wavers, that in a way, you know, more obsessed with this issue than the rest of the country? Are they in danger of falling back into that, Seamus?
It's damaging for the Tory party, I think. It's really problematic for them because it's such a schismatic issue for them. And of course, their reasons for hostility to Europe and the euro, European Union and the euro, are really to do with nationalism and some very pretty reactionary
attitudes. Can I say something heretical, Tom, on The Guardian? Perhaps the party is going to be most in trouble. This is Liberal Democrats, who are now at 8% in the polls and have supported an institution which is visibly falling apart in front of our eyes.
Gosh. Well, on that note of heresy, we'll leave that there. We'll delve back, though, into the first half of the 1990s. Britain's recovering from a recession, Labour's in opposition, desperate to establish itself as a party that can be trusted on the economy. A slight sense of deja vu there, but that's the backdrop to former MP Chris Mullin's last volume of diaries. I asked him if he has a feeling that he's seen it all before.
Well, in those days, Gordon Brown was the shadow chancellor, and he had this phrase which he used repeatedly, a package of measures. He was always appearing on television demanding a package of measures from the government. It was never very clear what the measures were, and our policy on interest rates appeared to be that they should be 0.5% lower than whatever the Tories said they should be at any given time. So I personally thought, and I think that comes over in the early pages of this volume of the diaries, that Gordon would not make a very good chancellor. I think I was wrong about that, as it turned out. He turned out to be a much better chancellor, at least for the first two-thirds of his time there, than I thought he would.
It's striking at the very start, in the preface to your book, you kind of list in a very modest fashion several things that you think you got wrong. One was being a bit scathing about Tony Blair and his decision to rewrite Clause 4. Another one was your doubts about whether Peter Mandelson had any real ability, and you've already mentioned there that you think you had it wrong perhaps about Gordon Brown. I mean, it's this very modest account, and one thing that strikes me as particularly striking about it is you've called this book a walk on part. The previous one of them was called A View from the Foothills, but reading this in the beginning of this book, I'm thinking it didn't have to be a view from the foothills at all. If you'd only decided to nominate Tony Blair, who you already decided to back, they were desperate for you, weren't they? They wanted some left-wing cover inside the big tent.
I don't think they were desperate for me, but I certainly think if I'd have been a bit more ambitious, I'd have ended up a rung or two higher in the pecking order. In fact, I have some reason to believe I might have become the Secretary of State for International Development had I not voted against the Iraq war. But that's all past history. Yes, what I say in the introduction to A Walk on Part is that, looking back, one realises how much Blair got right in the early years. He was surely right about wanting to drag the Labour Party kicking and screaming onto the centre ground of British politics and to keep it there. Of Mandelson, I say that, and it's obvious from the early diaries and indeed from other people's memoirs, that a great deal of time was spent on managing Peter Mandelson over the years, that he was a person of excellent judgment in every respect, except in relation to his own affairs.
Now, let's just spool forward a moment to 1997, where your Sunderland constituency I think, since your time in Parliament, been one of the very first to declare.
Since 1992, Sunderland South has always been the first seat to declare, sometimes by as much as 30 or 40 minutes before the next seat.
You're there as an incorrigible pessimist who's talked variously about maybe we'll get a majority of -5 and so on. And really, it's when your results are read out that the nation learns that the exit polls got it right.
Yes. Blair never thought, I think right up to the moment of the poll itself, that he was going to win by whatever it was, 179 seats. He thought that he was going to win. I no doubt in the last days he thought he was going to win slightly bigger, but he was looking at majorities of 20 or 30, no bigger. And I thought the same for most of that time. And I didn't really believe the exit polls, because we had been here before in 1992. And it wasn't till I arrived at my count and saw that my votes were in the 27,000s and my opponents had halved and were now down to 7,000 that polls were right and there was going to be a landslide. So I got to make the first soundbite of the great victory, as it were, and I said that from now on our country would be ruled on behalf of all its citizens, not merely on behalf of the prosperous.
This diary, unlike the more the previous publications, you know, this, we're working backwards here from the more recent years into the earliest years of New Labour, allows us to take a slightly longer sweep, probably, than when you're dealing with the decline and fall of Gordon Brown and all of that. As I say, you came from the always sensible but quite hard left of the party. And you say early on in 94 or 95 in the book, you're one of those who still wishes that Tony Benn had become leader in 1981. You know, that was almost 15 years after the event then, and now we're another 15 years on again. What do you think about that now?
Well, I'm part of that very small club who thinks that if Tony Benn and not Michael Foot and Neil Kinnock had been leader in the 80s, we'd have been better off than we were. We spent a lot of time in the 80s slugging it out with each other and also engaging in introspective, hunting for militants in the back streets of Liverpool. And we wasted a lot of time while Mrs. Thatcher got on with governing rather ruthlessly. And I don't think that would have happened if Ben had been leader. Do I think we'd have won the 83 election if he'd been leader? No, but we wouldn't have lost by anything like that wide margin. Mrs. Thatcher would have been opposed ideologically from the beginning, and that would have consolidated our vote. All those who were leaving would have left immediately had to become leader rather than lingering to inflict maximum damage and then drifting out towards the SDP. In 87, no, we'd probably have lost again, but again by a lesser margin. So, no, I don't think necessarily. I think the tide of history was against us in the 1980s, and whoever had been leader, we probably wouldn't have won. Would we have been better off? Yes, I think we would have been. And Ben would not have been an extreme leader. He would have compromised. The whole centre ground would have come over to him. How do I know that? Because when it looked as though he was going to win in September 1981, the centre ground started to move with remarkable agility. Someone who was a senior member of Blair's cabinet telephoned me at home in my little flat in Brixton. I wasn't a member of Parliament then. I was just a friend of Mr. Ben in September 1981 and said that he was going to be voting. He just wanted me to know that he would be voting for Tony, and he'd even persuaded one or two other members of the shadow cabinet to come over, and he'd put 50 quid on the outcome. Some years later, I was sitting next to him at a dinner, and he said, I abstained in the deputy leadership election.
And you said, no, you didn't.
I said, no, you didn't. You voted for Tony.
I've got the diary to prove it.
He said, how do you know that? I said, because you told me. You rang me up and told me. You've got a very good memory. He said, yes. I don't hold it against him, but the centre ground would have shifted. Yeah.
No, I can see that, but like, it's interesting to compare these two remarkable kind of Tony B's, I think, in a way, if we're taking a broad sweep. Because, you know, as I say, you were sceptical about Tony Blair's efforts in the early days to take on the party and to see this as a war against the party, rewrite Clause 4 and the rest of it. And yet you maintain when it comes to those early 80s days that Labour's energies would have been better spent not on infighting, not on taking on the party, but on having a stance of no enemies on the left and taking the fight to Mrs. Thatcher. Maybe not enough to have won, but maybe would have done rather better than, say, Michael Foot did. I just can't quite reconcile those two.
Well, it's not difficult to argue that one would have done better than Michael Foot did. Michael Foot was a lovely old chap, but he was wholly unsuited to leadership.
Okay.
Remember the mess we got into over the Falklands War. This is why Mrs. Thatcher won the 83 election. We got ourselves into the remarkable position of supporting the sending of the fleet, but not its use. Well, that was a wholly incredible position. Now, if Ben had been leader, we'd no doubt opposed the Falklands War, and we'd have no doubt suffered for that electorally, but at least we'd have had a credible position.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can see that, but I'm just saying that the business of... What I'm trying to get at is, and we'll come on to Ed Miliband to close this off in a minute, but what do you think? Do you think party leaders need to challenge their parties? As in the preface to your book, you say Tony Blair was right to do, or do you think they should concentrate on taking the fight to the enemy, as you're saying Tony Benn would have done in the 80s, and that would have been the better strategy? Or was it just different times, and therefore you needed a different tactic?
Well, it was different times. As I say, by 1994, we'd lost four elections in a row. And it was quite clear Blair had thought very carefully how to win back the middle ground. I think that's Blair's great contribution to the Labour Party. And it's actually one that Cameron taught the Conservative Party. After the Conservatives lost in 1997, they headed right back to their core vote, as we did in the late 70s and perhaps early 80s. But Blair's great contribution was to demonstrate that you have to capture the centre ground. And I have a friend who worked in No. 10 Downing Street through the last three prime ministers. And he said to me that between themselves, Cameron and Osborne refer to Blair as the master.
Mm. And you, of course, refer to him as the man, don't you, by the middle of these diaries. OK, let's just bring this up to date then. I know it's a semi-historical document, as I say, 1994 to 1999, that we're talking about. I've been trying to tease out you know, how far your position's changed vis-a-vis the Labour Party. What about Ed Miliband and how he's doing now? You have this line after John Smith died, where you're obviously still struggling with the legacy of Neil Kinnock, and you say, oh, God, give me an honest right-winger rather than a kind of phony left-winger. What about Ed Miliband? Is he a phony left-winger or is he the real deal?
I don't think he's phony. I think he's got a very difficult task. Leading the Labour Party at any given time is a difficult task, especially in opposition, much harder being Labour leader in opposition than it is being Tory leader in opposition, because you've got most of the media trying to trip you up. Whether we win the next election or not will depend on whether we've got a credible story to tell on the economy. It will be won or lost on the economy, and the Tories have taken a huge gamble there, and it remains to be seen whether they'll get away with it. They might, because what Mrs. Thatcher demonstrated is that if you mobilise the fortunate with sufficient ruthlessness against the less fortunate, you can endure even 3 million unemployed and still get a majority.
Of course, the difference this time is pay's stuck as well, isn't it? So the middle's getting squeezed as well.
Well, that is indeed part of the difference. The other difference is, of course, Mrs. Thatcher had the great advantage of two great advantages. One, she had North Sea Oil to fund mass unemployment, which this lot don't have. And also she had the SDP to divide the anti-Tory vote straight down the middle. And that helped her stay in power throughout the 80s. Now, the Tories don't have that. They've got the Liberal Democrats propping them up at the moment, but I have a feeling they will not be a factor in the next election. I don't think Nick Clegg will even be leader of the Liberal Democrats by the next election. I'll go further. I don't think he'll even stand for Parliament at the next election. I think he'll go off to Europe or something, and I don't know whether that's right or wrong, but remember, you heard it here first.
Chris Mullin there, and the book A Walk on Part is out now. And the stage version of his diaries, believe it or not, is moving to London next month. Catch that at the Soho Theatre. Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks to Seamus Milne, to Larry Elliott, and to Nick Cohen. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.